Hello, everyone. I'm Tech Sergeant Shane Hughes, and you're listening to Beyond the Horizon, a podcast produced by the Ohio Air National Guard's 178th Wing in Springfield, Ohio. We have a very special guest for this episode. I'm proud to announce that Major General retired Ed Meckenbeyer is joining us for today's show. General Meckenbeyer graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1964, and just 3 years later found himself flying combat missions in Vietnam. On his 80th mission over North Vietnam, just 2 weeks short of returning home, he was captured and spent nearly 6 years as a prisoner of war. He served as the commander of the 162nd Fighter Squadron and has an award named in his honor. Today, he and Wing Commander Colonel Kimberly Fitzgerald joined us to talk about the 2020 Meckenbeyer Award winners, discuss the history of the award, and General Meckenbeyer shared his amazing story. This is truly a can't-miss episode. I hope you enjoy the show. Ma'am, would you begin by telling us what is the Major General Meckenbeyer Award? What is the history of the award, and what does it take to win it?
Sure. Thanks for asking. 3 years ago, when Colonel Hesterman was still here, we had discussed that we have many awards across the base that are for individuals, both quarterly awards and annual awards, but we didn't have a unit-level award. So we wanted to establish an award that recognized a unit or a squadron across the base that was doing extraordinary things. And working together as a team, basically. So we decided to establish a team award, and then we had to figure out what the name of the award was going to be. And in order, you know, as we look back in history, most of us know about the amazing teamwork and camaraderie it took for the members of the, or the prisoners, basically, in the Hanoi Hilton to be able to survive, outlast, and come home. And so we decide, and we have General Meckenbeyer was a Sabre, a member of the 178th Wing. So we thought that it would be great to name the unit award in his honor to recognize outstanding achievement and teamwork at the wing. So 3 years ago, so this year is our third winners, basically.
And so who won the 2020 Meckenbeyer Award, and what were their accomplishments?
So in 2020, obviously, was defined by COVID and civil unrest. So it was a very unusual year for sure. And we actually had it was a great competition. All the submissions were outstanding. Our unit has done amazing things out in the community, helping with the state with the response to COVID and then also the response to civil unrest, all the while still getting the mission done around here. So we actually decided this year to award the Meckenbeyer Unit Trophy to two units, and that was our Security Forces Squadron and the Medical Group, because both have just been working nonstop, tirelessly, 24/7, supporting our state response for COVID and for civil unrest. So two squadrons shared the award this year, and it was neck and neck all the way, so we just couldn't decide, and they've both done amazing things, so we decided to make them co-winners.
Colonel, thank you for inviting me down here, and Shane. It's an honor to have any legacy, but again, you know, that's one point. The fact that whatever it is that made you decide to name this after me is because of all the wonderful people I got to work with, again, picking up on the theme of the award itself. So rather than an individual recognition, I take it as a thank you for what I and all the people that I was associated with during my time here were able to do.
So with that in mind, sir, can you tell me a little bit about your history in the military?
Like a lot of people, I had no military background. I was the oldest of 8 children. And I went to the Air Force Academy because I lost a $5 bet with my dad. My dad said, as the oldest of 8 kids, if you want to get a college education, you better get some good scholarships. He was a plumber and a steam fitter. And he said, I bet you $5 if you try for one of these military academies, you can make it. That was my only motivation to go take the civil service test, do the interviews and everything else. And eventually I was appointed by the then congressman to go to the Air Force Academy in 1960. Graduated in 64, as you said. pilot training at Vance Air Force Base. First operational assignment was to Europe, where I was a F-4C aircraft commander. And then 66 of us volunteered, fingers quotes up here, to go to Vietnam after about a year in Europe. Went to Da Nang Air Base, a member of the 390th TAC Fighter Squadron, and flew 114 missions in Vietnam. And as you said, over my 80th over North Vietnam, I was shot down. Wasn't really shot down. I had an engine explosion. I had a maintenance malfunction at an inopportune time. And spent the next 2,193 days or whatever as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. Came home in 1973. I was assigned to the 4950th Test Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And for the pilots in the audience, it was a grand job. I was getting 80 flying hours a month in first pilot qualified in two aircraft, dual rated in that regard, and could fly any one of four or five other different airplanes. That was a blast. And then the Air Force came to me and said, "By Jove, you're done. Your flying career's over. You've got your 11 years of aviation service." And I said, "Oh, time out. I spent six of those 11 years sucking my thumb in a POW camp." "Oh, no, no, no. It counts toward the aviation service. You got to go off and do something else." Well, by now, I was hooked on flying airplanes. That's really all I wanted to do. So I got the brilliant idea. Well, they can fly F-100s out at Springfield. So I came over here one day. I went in to see Colonel Nick Lacey and Colonel Chops Hunter, who were the commanders of the group and the squadron at the time. Did an interview and asked them, says, "You need any pilots?" And they said, "What are you doing now?" I said, "I'm flying mostly F-4s at Wright Patton." "Well, come on over." And so that was on the 3rd of June, 1975. On the 30th of June, I left the Air Force, the active duty Air Force, and joined the Ohio National Guard. Flew 400s and A-7s here at Springfield until 1991. And then, I was playing golf one day with the four-star commander of Air Force then, Logistics Command, Charlie McDonald. And he asked me, he says, "Well, Ed, how are things going?" I said, "Well, great, sir. I said, I'm coming up on 28 years as kind of mandatory retirement for Lieutenant Colonel." And he says, "What do you mean, retire?" I said, "Well, sir, Lieutenant Colonel in the Ohio Air National Guard. There's no 06 a flying job available in the state for me, so I might as well retire. Give me more time to play golf." He says, "You ever think about coming back on the other side?" I said, "No." 2 weeks later, I'm playing golf with then Major General Ed Bracken and General McDonald. And he says, "Well, Ed, congratulations." I says, "What do you mean?" "Don't you know?" I said, "Know what?" "General McDonald transferred you to the reserve. You got a reserve commission now, and you're coming to work for him." So Lieutenant Colonel McIntyre went into the Air Force Reserve component. Now I've been on active duty, Air National Guard, Air Force Reserve, either can't get a job or having great opportunities. And so I served the next, 13, 14 years as a member of Air Force Reserve Command, serving in Air Force Materiel Command and Logistics Command in several different capacities. Retired in 2004.
Wow, that is a very, that is a
diverse
career. That's a great way of saying that. So I'm curious, was that $5 bet worth it?
Absolutely. I mean, it turned out, it's serendipity. I mean, you couldn't write. I mean, like everybody in the 60s, I was, you know, enamored of becoming an airline pilot. That's what I wanted. That's where the big bucks was. That's where the glory was. So I was thinking about getting out of the Air Force and going to work. In fact, I actually even applied for American Airlines, knowing that I had to come home. I had one more year to serve. I was going to go to Duluth and fly F-106s for the last year. And that got sidetracked, obviously. But then, you know, looking back on it, I'd say, you know, getting shot down and disrupting the life pattern that I was on turned out to be such a fortunate thing in so many ways. It's unbelievable. But not just the fact that I eventually became a Major General in the United States Air Force, which in itself is an honor way beyond anything I thought I'd achieve. But it was a good thing. I mean, all the bad set aside, the way it changed my life, impacted my life, changed everything about my life. I'm so very grateful. I wouldn't have ever been a member of the greatest flying unit in all the world, the Ohio Air National Guard, if I hadn't been shot down. So life is good.
I think like your career is a testament to being open to change. Like you had a plan and then you got diverted and you did something else. And then someone else like opened another door for you and you chose to walk through that door and take the opportunity. And then looking back now, like what a career and all these accomplishments. So I love, like you said, the diversity of your career. It's amazing.
Yeah. At my retirement, though, I have to tell you, my opening line was, well, when you're getting run out of town on a rail, get in front and make it look like a parade. And that's literally a way to look at my career. You know, I don't know that I could take an 8-penny nail and drive it through a whole lot that Ed Meckenbauer accomplished. But again, Colonel, I'll go back to your opening comment. You know, if you work with people, if you recognize that you're part of a team, yet they support you, you support them, it's amazing what can happen. And I've been blessed by being associated with great people. And I've been fortunate to, you know, stand on their shoulders or let them stand on mine, whichever way you want to look at it. And like I said just a couple minutes ago, you know, life is good. I mean, where am I going to go back and change something? You can look at all the good, you can look at all the bad. But the sum total, to me, it's unbelievable. It's one of those things like my dad would say, yeah, that's my boy. And my mom would say, how the heck that happened to him? You know, it's just life happens. Embrace it. Enjoy it. Don't take yourself too seriously. And don't ever forget that you are not self-made.
So I'm curious, you served in all three components, the mm-hmm. active duty, the guard, and the reserves. Mm-hmm. How did those experiences differ from one another, and which one did you like best?
Well, obviously, I like the Air National Guard best. And really, that's an interesting question in that, you know, the Guard today is so much different than what it was when I was there. I mean, we were flying F-100s initially, and we were going to go fight the Russians in Central Europe. Didn't happen. That was our big mission, flying F-100s. A-7s, the mission was largely the same. But we also picked up an additional role providing air defense coverage for the Panama Canal. Pretty important mission there, I should suspect. You know, but nowadays, I mean, if you want to say that the Air National Guard in those days was a flying club, really kind of was. You know, we were professional. We were trained and expected to perform and did perform to the same standards as the active duty people. We weren't nearly as involved in the real world as you all are today. I mean, just the winners of the award, the nominees of the award. I mean, you can go by, you could give that award to anybody of those, of the people who were nominated over any year. You people are involved, you're engaged, you're critical. And nowadays, what, 21% of our deployed Air Force is reserve component? 43% of our deployed Army is reserve component? So the Air National Guard, the Army National Guard, the Army Reserve, and the Air Force Reserve are integral to the ability of this nation to perform its defense mission. So, what was the highlight? Yeah, flying F-100s because it was cool.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience as a prisoner of war? Can you just start with the day of that 80th mission? How did that day begin? Walk me through that, please.
That day began with my first recollection of that day was lunch. Now, I had green beans and ham and mashed potatoes in the chow hall at the Doom Club, a Da Nang officer's open mess. And then I went down to the squadron. It wasn't on the flying schedule that day. And the commander, later became General Sandy Vandenberg, said, Ed, we're short one crew for the afternoon mission to Hanoi, actually to the Vu Chu Railroad Yard, 30 miles northeast of Hanoi. I didn't have to take that mission because I had flown 75 combat missions over North Vietnam, and the kind of rule was you didn't fly to Hanoi on your first 10, and you didn't have to fly to Hanoi after you had 75, more heavily defended, more exposure. You know, I figured that pretty soon the duck goes across the pond often enough, you know, after 75, you're more likely to get caught. So, and then you flew missions in the lower route packages to North Vietnam, so you still get your counters. So I said, well, let me check with my backseater, Kevin McManus. So I said, Kevin, we don't have to take this mission, but, you know, they're short a qualified crew. What do you say? And he said, let's go for it. So we jumped in as a Chisel 4 in a 54 aircraft strike package on the railroad yard, and as I said, 30 miles northeast of Hanoi. And First Lieutenant Aircraft Commander, one of two in all of Southeast Asia, you know where I was. I was blue last. And we rolled in on the target. Interesting thing about the F-4, the engines were notorious for smoking. So we'd always put one engine in minimum afterburner so it didn't smoke, the other engine in idle, just to make it a little harder to see us visually coming in at the target. We came in on the target at 15,000 feet like we did every day. This day we happened to be doing it underneath a 16,000 foot overcast, so the bad guys knew exactly what our altitude was. We rolled into the target, and just like World War II, the best way to hit something in those days before all the electronic gadgetry we have now to put the weapon right smack dab on the target, we rolled in. It was a 90 degrees nose low, aim at the target, go through 9,000 feet, pickle and pull. And we did that. The F-4 had a limitation. You could not light the afterburner above 600 knots. So, as I said, one engine was in the afterburner going down this hill. The other engine was in idle. And then once you dropped your bombs, the idea was to get out of Dodge as fast as you could. So, and your airspeed gained up well over 600 knots in the dive. And so pull out, and the first thing you do is you start looking at the airspeed indicator. And as soon as it went below 600 knots, you let the other afterburner, so you get a little more scoot. Well, let the other engine in, and it exploded. Now, whether it was hit or, you know, whatever, interesting thing, though, I'd flown that same airplane 5 days previous and been hit. And that engine I had to shut down because it was on fire. And I took the airplane into Udorn, Thailand. And this was the first time the airplane flew after it was fixed, quote fingers again. So we were pretty close to the target area. The airplane lost all the hydraulics. It was just turned into, according to one of the other guys, it was just this big orange fireball kind of arcing through the sky. So it had the nose up a little bit, trying to get above 4,500 feet to get above the small arms fire, get above 11,000 feet to get above the 37 millimeter fire. As fast as I could. And this airplane is just arcing, and it starts doing cartwheels. And I had no ailerons, but the rudder was still working. The F-4 had all hydraulic flight control system, no manual backup, no electric backup. And every time it would come right side up, I could stop it by stamping on the right rudder for just a few seconds, and I just kind of ratchet, and then boom, it snapped over again. And each time it did, the nose got a little bit lower, a little bit lower, a little bit lower. And after it went over six times, this wonderful, rest his soul, gentleman sitting 6 feet behind me in the F-4, Kevin Joseph Patrick McManus, said, "Ed, I don't think we're going to make it. Don't bother me. I'm in complete control. I'm the world's greatest fighter pilot. Ed, I don't think we're going to make it." And boom, kind of snapped me out of my little funk there. And I said, "Bail out, Kevin, bail out." And that's what the word you're supposed to use when you tell somebody to get out of an airplane. But I always told him if he heard the second one, he would be second out of the airplane. I said, "Bail out, Kevin." He said, "Sayonara, Ed." And that's all it took. We came out of the bottom of that previously mentioned fireball in perfect formation. Over a bunch of people who were very upset. The airplane was doing about 620 knots at the time. Last airspeed I saw, about 4,500 feet, upside down. Short parachute ride into a crowd of people who had been shooting at us on the way down, but they didn't hit us. And so all this wonderful training, escape and evasion, ducking, bobbing, weaving through the jungle, landed on top of a roof of a building, a very top peak, rolled down the side, thudded onto the ground, completely tied up, right at the feet of all my captors. And that began, all wrapped up in my parachute.
Did you have any injuries from that?
Short version, anytime you jump out of a moving object at over 700 miles an hour, there are injuries. I used to be an inch and a quarter taller, compression fracture from the old Martin Baker ejection seat, which is like sitting on a 21G rocket shell. The flailing industry, you know, just jumping out of the wind blast, arms flail, hyperextension of the thorax to be medically correct, which led to some scar tissue and first of several dislocations of the shoulders. Is what it is.
So what happened after that?
Well, let's say I landed right in the middle of them. The first thing they did, and I use the less fighter pilot description here, they got out machetes and cut every stitch of clothing off my body. No Velcro undone, no snaps undone, no buckles undone. Everything was cut off. It got a little interesting at certain areas of the body with two guys with big, long machetes. And then they gave me a blue loincloth to wrap around me. And they paraded me through a bunch of towns where people were throwing rocks and beating us and sticking things in us, trying to burn us with cigarettes. Got shot down at 2:15 in the afternoon. The TOT was 2:15, so it was just a couple minutes after that when we were shot down. Ran us through a bunch of towns, put us up on a firing squad. Had air raid trenches that they drug us in front of, Kevin and I, and it just looked just like graves. And they said, "You die." And so in Vietnamese, firing squad, guys got their guns. More pictures. Now you die. Feet against the bottom of the side of the grave. Small children, back up. No kids. Now you die. Third time, more high. And everybody broke out laughing. It was just a trick to scare the crap out of us, which probably did.
Yeah.
And then they ran us again through all the towns and put us that night up against a bamboo wall and brought the kids in to throw rats and mice and sticks and stones at us and things like that. And old people were shaking their fists and yelling and screaming at us. But even during all that, there were a few people who bowed their head, nodded, and smiled at us. And one time I had my back against the bamboo wall and a voice in English said, "What is your name?" So I said, "Ed McIntyre." And that was all they said. That was the only night. Of course, I couldn't see him. They were on the back of this little woven bamboo wall behind us. Did the same thing to Kevin. "What is your name?" He was about 6 or 7 feet away from me, a separate target. And that turned out apparently to be how people knew that Ed McIntyre and Kevin McManus were alive, because the source eventually got the word back and reported the name Robert McIntyre. And they figured that was close enough. So 2 months after I was shot down, it was confirmed that I was still alive. About 2 o'clock in the morning, the regular army came and saved us from these people. But the interesting thing there was that they tied us up, and there's a lot of pictures about the hog-tying routine that the Vietnamese did to us, which basically involved dislocating your shoulders and tying your arms to your feet. And they put us in a helicopter, upside down, and flew us to Hanoi, the 30 miles to Hanoi, and then put us in the Wallow prison, the Hanoi Hilton. So that was day one.
Wow.
I can't even imagine.
Well, you know, there were a lot of guys already gone through that, and training helps you get through it. First, there's a little bit of shock that gets you through a little bit of it, too. But, you know, the key thing in any time you're in a very stressful situation like that is don't lose it. I mean, it may not be in complete control, but you're not completely lost. And so training becomes invaluable. And then once you get through that first stage, you know, and they're doing everything they can to isolate you, put you in solitary confinement, and then you start realizing, okay, number one, I'm not dead. Number two, I'm not alone. People are trying to communicate with me. I'm trying to communicate with them. We are in this together. And the first guy I talked to, the first guy who made contact with me using the tap code and a wire through a hole in the wall, had been there 2 years.
Wow.
Navy Lieutenant Commander Bob Shoemaker. And Bob Shoemaker was always my inspiration. If Bob could have been there for 2 years doing that, when I got shot down, by Jove, I could do it too.
The Hanoi Hilton is probably the most notorious prisoner of war camp, I think, in military history, to my mind. What was that like?
Well, for those of you who've been up on the old Spring Street in Columbus, where the old Ohio Penitentiary was, very much looked kind of like the same thing, except they had a yellow-orange stucco on the outside of the Hanoi Hilton as opposed to the stone walls. But it was a stone prison built in the 1870s by the French to put Vietnamese prisoners in. The Ohio Pen was built in the 1890s. So, I mean, the architecture is about the same. And the Hanoi Hilton was the Vietnamese name. Hoa Lo is like hellhole or hotspot or something like that. And that's really what it was. It was, like I said, built by the French to put Vietnamese prisoners in. So everything was about 80% of the size that it would be for us to be comfortably accommodated in terms of space. A bunch of 9 by 9 foot cells with concrete slabs. Put two guys in there. So I spent basically 4 years in a 9 by 9 cell with Kevin Joseph Patrick McManus. You know, of all the people who got shot down, they then spend 4 years with one other guy who I'd known since 1960. I didn't even get to meet any new people for a long time. You know, here I was communicating covertly with lots of people, not the least of which was Commander Shoemaker. But so I know Kevin Joseph Patrick McManus very well. And sadly, several years ago, I got to speak at his funeral, eulogize him. And he was probably the one guy who was a rock. Now, Kevin and I had gone to the Air Force Academy together. We'd gone to pilot training together. In those days, they were putting pilots in the back seat, and through a fickle finger of fate, I got to become an aircraft commander very early. And Kevin was my backseater. And we were in Europe together, did a lot of things over there, went to Vietnam together, flew 100-plus missions together. We were very close. And then to get shot down. I already knew Kevin. I didn't have any time to learn about somebody else's background, about all the train stations between New York City and out in the end of Montauk Point, Long Island, where he was from. You know. But a wonderful gentleman, a great guy, and the first example, like to go back again to the commander's perspective, the first person with whom I knew existence was dependent on not being alone. And that's the one thing we did in Vietnam is we were, first off, the average age of the guy to get shot down was 33. It was an old man's war. There were a lot of people in the Air Force who hadn't seen any combat. This is their chance to go to war and get some medals, make a career for themselves. So Kevin and I were obviously on the younger end of the age spectrum. But at the same time, you know, we'd had those people who were there ahead of us. We'd had training. We'd had been through, you know, survival schools and things like that. So it wasn't like we were going into this thing much better than some previous wars where people, horrible stories, but people in Korea, for example, going in a corner and rolling up and curling up and, you know, just letting themselves mentally and physically expire. We didn't have any of that. I mean, older crowd, motivated, and very, very much we considered ourselves still combatants. We were just, as the song says, fighting on from a cell. And so we just never let the Vietnamese get us down. We weren't about to let them do it. And we had little wins, you know, in fighting against them and things like that. And but it was an interesting 6 years that I would trade for about 5 minutes just to say I'd been there, done that. But it made an impact on all of us. And again, you know, not that we were trained any better, that we were morally, physically, professionally any better than anyone else. We were just those who happened to have the chance to demonstrate what the American fighting person is capable of doing in a unique situation. And that's my message. You talk about the things I try to do. You know, don't ever sell yourself short. I don't care if you are a basic recruit coming back from basic training down in Texas. Somebody thinks you're a hero. It may be a kid brother. It may be somebody who lives next door. Every one of us is a hero to somebody. Don't ever forget that. And if you have the chance to network that with a bunch of other people, you can be a hero to more people. But everybody has got a contribution. Everybody's got worth. Everybody has inner strengths and qualities and skills, aptitudes that need to be shared. And that's why you have success in any organization. I mean, a superhero on a football team gets all the accolades and wins the big bucks. But unless he's got the five linemen or six linemen in front of him, he's flat on his back. And that's the same way that analogy fits for everything in life. You're never by yourself. And as soon as you think you're self-made, to go back to a comment I made earlier, that's your unraveling.
I love the connections piece of that too. Like, we talk about connections are so important between people, and you and Kevin and your relationship going into North Vietnam and then through the Hanoi Hilton and then all the way, all these years afterwards. Yeah. It is an amazing story of friendship and connection. And it's very inspiring.
And it goes along with not taking yourself too seriously. Here I am, the world's greatest fighter pilot, and I went away for 6 years, and the doggone world kept going on without me. Come on, give me a break. How important am I? Maybe not so much. So, you know, so I had an attitude, too. I was 24 years and 50 weeks short of my 25th birthday. Old when I got shot down, so I was 2 weeks short of my 25th birthday. And I said, I'll be doggone if I'm going to spend the significant event, my 25th birthday, in this crappy place. So I took a year off every year I was there. When I came home, I was 17, and I'm back up to 27 now. So, I mean, it's an attitude. I mean, if you take yourself seriously, you're going to be disappointed. If you're willing to be part of a team and to enjoy and contribute and be rewarded for what the team does rather than what I did, life is a whole lot more enjoyable for you and those who have to put up with you.
Earlier in your story, you had mentioned that in the first days of your captivity, that some of the Vietnamese were maybe not necessarily kind to you, but showed a certain amount of humanity and dignity towards you. Was there any of that with your captors?
No.
No.
No. There was one interrogator who showed up, and we called him Stag. He lasted about 2 months. And he'd get us outside, and rather than take us to one of the torture rooms or interrogation rooms, when you had an interrogation with Stag, it was very often on the stoop outside your cell. And his line was, you know, you were wearing better clothes when you were shot down than I'll ever have in my life. And if it wasn't for our Chinese and our Russian benefactors, we wouldn't even have what we do have. That's why we're fighting. He'd bring English books for us to read. You know, admittedly, most of them had a propaganda flavor to them, but he would bring us books to read. And then one day, kind of tearfully, he announced that he was being reassigned. There was a need for interrogators in the South. He was the one person in the entire experience that ever showed any kind of humanity. To the other extreme, you had to really be careful when somebody acted like they were going to do it, because we had one guard that we called Psycho just because he just seemed to get a kick out of kicking you and anything else he could do. He'd smile at you and he'd flip you off and you flip him off, because that's the way fighter pilots say hello to each other, and we taught the Vietnamese that was the proper way to interact. Okay, it's going to be a good day, and you come up from your bow, because you had to bow 90 degrees every time a Vietnamese was in your presence, and he'd try to burn you with a cigarette. So you just never knew. You know, there's no consistent good guy, bad guy, other than Stag, other than the fact that the rest of them are all bad.
Can you tell me about any of the other prisoners that you were held captive with? I know you had the your backseater in the cell with you and Robert Schumacher that you were communicating with. Was there anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, for the first several years until 1969, so for the first 2 years, you know, it was mostly either isolation or one or two other guys with you. And then after Ho Chi Minh died, torture and daily physical abuse at the whims of the guard kind of changed, and the treatment got, quote, better, less severe. And we moved in with Joe Milligan, a animal husbandry major from Rutgers University, and Navy Lieutenant Junior Grade Gary Anderson. And so now there were four of us living together, and I can still tell you about all the five compartments of a cow's stomach from Joe Milligan. As I say, it was an animal husbandry major from Rutgers. I could tell you about all the lifestyle that Gary Anderson from California lived and things like that. So, yeah, those are the first two guys we lived with. And then later on, you know, things got a little better. And then in 1970, the Vietnamese started moving us out of prison camps in and around Hanoi. There were several others. Besides the Wallow Hilton, there were several other smaller places because they tried to keep us decentralized in terms of being able to communicate. That was their thing, big thing in life. And I know you both, of course, you, Shane, with your career and the colonel because of her position, you know, communication is so important. It's the lifeblood. It's the key. It's the link. It's the glue that holds everything together and forms a team. So the Vietnamese knew that they had to keep us apart, and that's why they kept us in small groups, 1, 2, and then after things got better, 3 and 4. And then by 1970, they started moving us out of Hanoi. We went to a place not far from San Tay. I watched the San Tay raid, which was interesting because most of the guys who were at San Tay were at this other place where I was. At camp, we called it Camp Faith, about 20 miles outside of Hanoi. And so I got to live with 7 or 8 other guys. And interesting, again, because we were Navy and Marines in there as well. And then the last year I spent up on a severe isolation camp. They said it was for bad boys. There were 108 of us up there on the Chinese border, where we were back to day one again, and, you know, 1 and 2 men in a cell. And up here I lived with the Navy Lieutenant Junior Grade by the name of Bob Weideman. So, again, you know, it's fascinating, you know, to kind of be thrust into a situation where you've got nothing to do except talk about yourself because there's nothing going on in the world that you with what you're all aware. So you get to know these guys in pretty good depth. And, of course, you tell them things that you'd never tell anybody else. And as I as I said at Kevin's funeral, you know, there are things about Edward John Francis McIntyre that Kevin Joseph Patrick McManus knows that no other living person will ever know. And the only difference is I know all of Kevin's secrets, but mine have gone to the grave.
You had mentioned the San Tay raid. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. Would you mind telling me what that is?
The Vietnamese always told us that we were going to be there forever. And in the summer of 1970, the Vietnamese opened up a prison camp, again, after Ho Chi Minh died in 1969. In 1970, the Vietnamese started ameliorating, big word for a fighter pilot, the treatment. And they moved us to some outlying POW camps. And one of them was San Tay, which is about 20-25 miles southwest of Hanoi. I was moved to a camp we called Camp Faith, about a similar area, 5 or 6 kilometers away from San Tay. But the Americans decided that they had to make an attempt to extricate some POWs because, you know, we were going to be there forever. So they had identified San Tay Camp as someplace where there were supposedly 100 Americans being held. And they started planning. It was an elaborate and a wonderful example of cooperation and teamwork. Army and Air Force trained out at Eglin Field and Herbert Field in Florida to infiltrate into North Vietnam. And anybody who hasn't read it, you got to read a book about the San Tay raid, because there's no way in this podcast I can describe the unique airmanship, the planning, the skill, the execution of this raid onto the camp. That all started in July. The Vietnamese, no indication that they were aware that anything was in the work, but San Tay was supposedly in a floodplain and it was coming up on a race. They took all the guys out of San Tay sometime in the July, August, September timeframe and moved them to other camps. But the Americans didn't know that. They kept planning this attempt to rescue American POWs. And so the San Tay raid in November of 1970 was an attempt by a Colonel Bull Simons in the United States Army and a wonderful team, and General Manor on the Air Force side. C-130s flew into North Vietnam within 20, 30 miles of Hanoi with their flaps down so they could go slow enough to have the helicopters C-130s were providing pathfinding through the mountains at night, and they hit the Santé camp, and a great testament to the planning and thing. There was only one injury, no fatalities. One guy broke an ankle when the CH-53 crash landed in the compound. It was part of the shock effect before they blew it up. But there were no prisoners there. They had all been moved to other camps. And so we watched it. Didn't know what it was at the time, but wow, lots of airplanes and lots of diversionary things, because the Navy provided diversionary airstrikes up on the other side of town to get the radar people looking that way so they wouldn't see the infiltrating and exfiltrating C-130s and helicopters. So anyhow, it was an attempt in November of 1970. Now, the follow-on from that, of course, is the Vietnamese panicked. And so all these years we've been living in small groups. They put us all back in the Hanoi Hilton. And now they're putting us in large rooms. They were like 35, 37, depending on which cell you were. These were rooms that were larger, just concrete slabs. I mean, nothing in them except like warehouse rooms with concrete slabs. They were built, that's where they held a lot of the Vietnamese, the French held the Vietnamese. So anyhow, they were in this large group now, and now we had, in my cell, we had like 38 guys for the first time. I mean, the Vietnamese wanted to get us together where they could kind of protect us. And this was nonstop. You talk about meeting people and talking to people you never seen. Guys of whom you'd just been tapping through the wall. You had no idea whether they were tall, skinny, short, fat, blue, black, green, whatever color, hair, or face, or skin, or head, and where they were from. So now we can start talking to each other. And it was amazing. And so that lasted for about 6 months. Now, the bad thing was the Vietnamese figured we had transmitters, we had all kinds, none of which we had. I mean, nobody was ever successful in getting anything to us because we didn't get anything. There was no Red Cross presence or anything else like that for early on. Later on, we were able to get small packages. But the Vietnamese took most of the stuff that was in it, and so out of a two-pound package, you got practically nothing. But anyhow, the Vietnamese took everything away from us. I mean, we were down now to the skivvy shorts we had, and after Ho Chi Minh died, we even got a second blanket, which was nice because it got cold in Hanoi. We took one of the two blankets away. So for about 6 months, we lived in these big rooms, had great camaraderie. We called that Camp Unity. That's where we started teaching classes, having really comparatively a little bit of fun. And like I said, it lasted until May of 1971, when the Vietnamese figured that the threat was over and started parsing us out again to smaller groups. And like I said, I was sent up to a camp in the Chinese border up in the air identification buffer zone, so there'd be no Americans flying up there with China. And we went back to square one in terms of accommodations, if you will. But the Santé raid was an attempt in 1970 by some great Army and Air Force people to come extricate prisoners of war. Now, interesting thing about it was military intelligence, joke time here. They started planning after the camp was empty. But anyhow, I mean, it's still a tip of the hat to the wonderful folks who made the attempt. And, you know, it might have set our treatment back to square one. But at the same time, for the first time, we were together and able to really organize. And we talked about the 4th Allied POW Wing. All the previous years, there were kind of notional ideas about who was in charge. And we'd, like I say, we'd find out who the senior ranking guy was in even the smallest group. But now we had a way of getting larger groups together. We came up with some communication techniques amongst the large rooms, and that's when we really became the 4th Allied POW Wing. We call ourselves Allied POW Wing because we had three Thai prisoners of war with us and four South Vietnamese prisoners who had been observers in light aircraft or helicopters that got shot down.
Please forgive me if this is kind of a dense question. What was the point of putting you back into those smaller camps, like the one on the Chinese border?
They were afraid that we would that there'd be another attempt to come get us. And so by putting us in the smaller camps and dispersing us, It made the task for an invasion force, if you will, to come locate Americans and take them out. Just imagine how embarrassing it would have been for the North Vietnamese government if the Americans had come in and plucked 100 guys out of downtown Hanoi, practically, at San Tay. Okay, there is no place in your country that's safe from our reach. No place. So they panicked. They really, really did. They were scared.
So, Shane asked about your day one. Uh-huh. Can you walk us through like how you felt and, you know, your last day, the come home day, the joy day, I guess?
Well, actually, it was 5 days. When the protocols were signed, the Vietnamese had a requirement to tell us about it within 5 days. They told us 4 days, 23 hours, and 30 minutes into that period. And for the first time ever, they pulled us out of our cells. And now we were living in groups of maybe, you know, 7, 8, 10 people. And we were allowed to form up in a military formation. First time ever that they allowed us all to be outside. And just because of our mentality. You know, our senior officers went to the front and us lieutenants are in the back. And the Vietnamese read the protocols to us. And everybody just turned around and walked away. Didn't believe it. It's a lie. Can't happen. For years they've been telling us we were going to be there forever. And we believed them. But we didn't care because we were still fighting. And I think I've read some other accounts. You know, the Vietnamese were just absolutely dumbstruck that there weren't any cheers. We just walked away in silence. The protocol specified that the prisoners would be released in four groups, corresponding to the rejection of the last American troops in South Vietnam. So as a quarter of the troops in South Vietnam left, a quarter of the prisoners would be released. And that then came out to about 120, or about 450 of us, yeah, ultimately. So about 120 people in each release group over a two-week increment. Okay, fine. So we had already communicated through the senior officers and everything that we wanted to go home in the order we were shot down. And so I would have fit in that first 120. But there were people who were shot down and injured in the linebacker operation, B-52 guys and other fighter air crew who were injured and needed more immediate. And so we said, okay, put the seriously injured in that first group. So I got bumped back to the second group. No big deal. Again, you know, we're still kind of in disbelief. This is just a trick. I mean, it's not going to happen. And a couple days later, after the first group left on the 12th of February, the Vietnamese came in and picked out 20 of us and said, put these clothes on. And you see pictures of us coming out of jail with clothes we'd never worn before. Not the stripy pajamas or the black pajamas that we wore all the time. These were trousers and a jacket, not much unlike what I have on now. Shoes. What? Black shoes. You know, obviously we've been wearing sandals for years. And a little bag to carry home our trinkets. So, okay, now it's our turn. Hold it. We're all in the next group of 100 or so, but we're not the next 20 to go home. Something's wrong. We're not going. So we wouldn't put our clothes on. Vietnamese come in and say, your airplane's here. You must go. No. We're not the next 20. We're not going. We're all in that next group, but we're not the next 20 to be released. And so for 5 days, we basically walked around naked, and the Vietnamese kept yelling at us, put our clothes on, airplanes here, going to go. No, won't go. And our senior group, Navy Lieutenant Commander Jim Peary, and whenever there were two people together, there was a SRO. In fact, for one period of time, I was in a cell with three Air Force Academy graduates, so we all had the same date of rank, and Joe Milligan, the previously mentioned Rutgers University ROTC guy. So let me see. There's Ron Bliss, Ed McIntyre, and Kevin McManus. Okay. Bliss, you're the SRO because if y'all have the same data rank, you'd go alphabetically. As a matter of fact, Kevin outranked me. MC comes before ME. So I always blame Kevin for us getting shot down. I may have been the aircraft commander, but he was a senior man in the airplane. So, you know, that was always kind of a useless joke, but it's one that I was real. So anyhow, Commander Peary told me, says, no, unless somebody from the International Control Commission, four countries made up the International Control Commission, who had to inspect the site of your last detention, which again was someplace we'd never been before, much nicer than any place we were. And no, unless somebody from the International Control Commission or an American comes in here and tells us to leave, we're going to not go because it doesn't follow the protocols that you read to us. So eventually, an American Air Force colonel in uniform came to the camp. They called Commander Peary out to meet him. And the American colonel told Peary that, yes, it was a legitimate release. He was really an American. The war was over, and we were going to go home. And Peary said, well, I'm sorry. I've talked to the guys and to a man. If we're not the next 20, we're not going. So then Colonel Norm Gaddis, this gets a little emotional, I'm sorry. So Colonel Norm Gaddis was the senior ranking amongst the guys who were still there after the first group left, which included, some other colonels. And Colonel Gaddis told Peary, I don't know what's going on either, but my job is to get everybody out of here. So Peary came back and told us that Colonel Gaddis said to go. And we said, go back in time. Not next. It's not right. Don't want to go. And so he went back to Colonel Gaddis. A couple minutes later, Colonel Gaddis comes to the group, to the 20 of us, makes us line up, gives each one of us a direct verbal order. You will go home today. You will go home today. Okay, so reluctantly we put our clothes on, but told the Vietnamese, if there is one photograph, one photographer, one snap, one click, we're turning around walking back in, because we're not going to be part of a propaganda thing on your part. So we marched out of the Hanoi Hilton in a file, 10 deep, 2 wide, and got in the truck, and there was not one camera, not one. They drove us to Gia Lam Airport, and as we were in the bus going to Gia Lam Airport, we saw the C-141 land. Okay, first time now, we think, okay, this is kind of legitimate. We knew what a C-141 was anyhow. And the bus pulls into an area that was obviously a MiG-21 fighter squadron. And there was lots of food and drinks on the table, candies and things like that. So we filed in, and there were 2 rows of seats. We sat down. The Vietnamese said, oh, no, here, you must refresh yourself for your trip. No, we wouldn't move. And they said, your airplane has been delayed. Well, we just saw the thing land. Your airplane is delayed. You must refresh yourself. Be some time before you can go. We just sat there. Eventually, they realized that we were not going to, because they obviously had cameras stashed somewhere. They realized that this wasn't going to be an opportunity. They said, okay, your airplane's here. Let's go. So we got back in the buses, went over to the airport, to the tarmac where the 141s were. And then the Vietnamese never said, we have, and here's a complete list of all the people who are prisoners of war. The Americans had to ask. Do you have Everett Alvarez? Yes, we do. Do you have Bob Shoemaker? Yes, we do. Do you have Hayden Lockhart? Yes, we do. So the repatriation ceremony was, again, this colonel who was had come into the base, was the head of the delegation, sat there, and they would read a name, and the Vietnamese would check their list. Yep, boom. And you'd step forward, and you'd greet an American colonel, and then they would escort you to the airplane. One by one, they'd call the name, you'd acknowledge, step forward, you were officially transferred and got on the airplane. So I got on the airplane, and I sat down to a rather stout fella in a black suit, crew cut, dark glasses, and civilian, introduced myself. Hi, I'm Ed McIntyre. He says, yeah, I know. Oh, yeah? I'm Roger Shields. Oh, yeah, Roger, what brings you? I'm the Department of Defense guy in charge of getting you guys out of here. Where the hell have you been for the last 5 days? I said, what do you mean? So I gave him a quick recount. He says, well, do you know that you're part of a special release? I said, well, we didn't know that. And it certainly wasn't in accordance with the protocols that we wanted. Henry Kissinger made a trip to Hanoi. And as a sign of good gesture, the Vietnamese decided that they would release 20 people sooner than the 2 weeks after the first group. So rather than come out on the 24th, these guys were going to come out. We were supposed to come out on the 14th. We came out actually on the 18th. They gave Kissinger the list of the next 120 guys who were to be released and said, here, circle the people that you want. He went down that list and just randomly circled people. Interestingly enough, most of us had German names. And we became known as the Kissinger 20. It was a special release. It's completely honorable, but for 5 days, we wouldn't do it. Now, to go back to the original part of the question, still didn't think it was real. You know, until we got out of Vietnamese airspace, it was, okay, this isn't happening. This is a dream. It's all over. It's a fake. Because we'd had that dream. Of course, now we all have dreams about going back, that it really wasn't real, that it, well, we're still prisoners. I mean, that's the recurring nightmare that we still have even today. But anyhow, it wasn't really until the airplane was out of Vietnamese airspace and the pilot on the intercom said that we were. That's when we looked around and said, okay, this is real. We're going home. It's been uphill ever since.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I know that no part of sharing this story is easy, and we just really appreciate you being on the show today to share it with us.
Again, you know, everybody has got things in life that they look at and they say, I can't do that. I can't climb that mountain. I've never survived. We all have those things, and we survive them because of who we are and because of the people around us.
This podcast tends to be focused on leadership, to provide lessons for our younger airmen in leadership. So with that in mind, would you mind telling me, how did your experiences as a prisoner of war impact your views on leadership?
Yeah. I never commanded anybody. I never was the boss for anybody. I was the facilitator. I was a member of the team, much like the colonel is here. I was a member of the team. This is my job. You have your job. I will do what I need to do to resource and guide you to do your job. In Hanoi, I learned that, because I'm, not to get to my back, but I was one of the key communicators, the guy. I was the guy who helped develop the hand code with another fellow by the name of Ed Hubbard, that gave us that ability to communicate between buildings when we couldn't tap with each other through a wall. I was a lieutenant. My job was to give communication ability to the colonel, who was the senior ranking officer. He didn't tell me how to do my tap code. He didn't set up the abbreviations with which Ed Hubbard and I came up with so we could say TT is that. You know, G means ING at the end of a verb. You know, I had my job. So what I learned there was, yes, everybody has a role. Everybody has a job. Some people are diggers. Some people are fillers. Some people are policy writers. Some people are finance people. You know, without the guy who put gas in my jet here, I wouldn't have gone very far. I mean, Ray Kidd was my crew chief on an F-100, you know. I had such trust and faith that I didn't pre-flight that airplane when I went out there to fly it. I knew he did his job. And so that's, I think that's the one thing I learned, that everybody has, again, to go back, everybody is a role model to somebody. Everybody is a cog in the wheel that makes anything happen. So like I said earlier, so, you know, when I retired, I don't know that I could drive an 8-penny nail through anything Ed Meckenbauer did. But Ed Meckenbauer was part of a team of people who did things. My job was to set the boundaries, give them the resources to go do their job and come back. When I left the Air Force, I had 2,300 people who looked up to me at the top of the pyramid. And again, I still don't say they work for me, but you know, in the organizational structure, the military hierarchy, I was the peak, and there were 2,300 people scattered down doing different things. I couldn't begin to tell you what half of those people did let alone how they did it. But they did things. They made things happen. They were an integral part of other teams that made the network of networks that make things happen. The 178th operates as a unit. There are a lot of things that make that unit capable, but then it nets into other units doing the same thing. Without this, without that, you know, oops, weakest link, slowest ship. You know what I'm saying? So we go back to something very simple. A good friend of mine by the name of Ron Fogelman, who was chief of staff of the Air Force, came up with these core values: integrity first, excellence before self. Integrity first, service before self, excellence in all we do. How hokey is that? But guess what? That's what you expect of somebody who works on your teeth, who works on your body, who works on your house, who works on your car, who teaches your kids. We're not different because we've got core values. But we've codified them a little bit. You know, that's what's expected of you. Oh, by the way, you can expect that of me. So that's the framework in which our team operates. We've just done a little better job of looking each other in the eye and say, okay, integrity first, excellence, and all we do, service before self. That's what makes it work. So that's what I learned. I mean, that was a big lesson I learned. And so again, you know, how did Ed McIntyre get the sponsorship, get the mentorship to whatever it was to have him go to that review board, for the McIntyre Award, you know? 14,000 people come up. I was the president of the Active Duty Colonel Board one year. 15,000 people from 05 to 06. Every one of them, a few exceptions. Fantastic. Splendid. Wonderful. How can we not promote this person? Oh, we got a 22% promotion rate. And I got to go to the Secretary of the Air Force and defend the decision of all these people who are on the board. How do you do that? You know, fine line. Sometimes it's a little subjective. Sometimes it's objective if you're lucky. So the thing I learned was, you know your spot. Know your place. Know your role. Do it. Don't do somebody else's job. Don't try to tell them how to do their job because they just make you look bad.
So kind of along that same vein, what leadership advice do you have for young airmen today?
Yeah, don't be shy. You know, there are things going on here that this commander knows happens, has no idea how it happens. And if she did, 6 months from now, there'd be a better way of doing it. Did she go down and tell somebody how to do that better? Probably not. Somebody down there doing the job. Hey, you know, if I did that, or if we just tweaked this, it'd be a better way. How do you lead? By example. How do you lead? By being innovative, being imaginative. Always respectful of the military, because we are military. There's a hierarchy, I mean, things like that. But you've got to be innovative. So don't just sit back and say, oh, boy, I got a sucky position in this organization. Make it better. If you think you got a sucky job, guess what? You got a sucky job. And who knows best how to make that job valuable, a contributing part of the organization? You do. If you got an idea, run up the flag. Doesn't mean that every idea you have is going to be accepted by the boss, going to be endorsed, and that, you know, she's going to give you credit for it. But keep trying. And again, go back. Every one of you out here in this organization is a role model to somebody. Don't take yourself, because you're learning skills, experience, relationships that when you make that next grade, you make that next rank, are going to serve you in good stead. So I don't care if you're here just for 4 years or if you're here for 6 years or 44 years like I was in uniform. You know, you're never going to forget the core values. You're never going to forget the core relationships. You're never going to forget the skills and associations that you have right now. So, you know, I've got a son who's sweating out the senior master sergeant board right now. You know, be his first time up. Nobody ever makes it the first time up. But he's got a commander who thinks he's pretty top drawer and deserves to make it the first time around. So we're kind of, you know, how did he get to where he is? You know, just always trying to do the best he could at whatever it is. And not saying no when somebody says, you can't do that. respectfully saying, hey, here's a better way we can do this. So he's a little aggressive. But then again, he's operating within the guidelines and military protocols, the customs and courtesies that are essential part of our organization. So that's how you be a good leader. That's how you become a good student and a good practitioner of leadership. I don't care if you're an E1 or an E9. I mean, we all have qualities and skills that are part of the team, an essential part. Recognize that. Don't sell yourself short. You are the world's greatest fighter pilot. Convince me I'm not. That's an attitude.
All right, so that concludes it for all of my questions. Is there anything I forgot to ask, anything you would like to add, or that people should know?
You don't have time for me to impart all the wisdom and knowledge that I need to do, and if the world would only make me king. No. No, again, you know, it's just an amazing organization, and the transformation that has happened in the physical plant here at Springfield, in the mission here at Springfield, the stature of the military person in our country, you know, you are the best and the brightest. And this is the greatest generation, you know. But be proud of the legacy that went before you. Be proud of your past and your heritage. And look to see how you can make this organization, this wing, even better than it already is.
Thank you very much, sir. I truly appreciate your time today. This is one of the interviews that I will remember for the rest of my life. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes today's episode of Beyond the Horizon. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe and leave us a rating and review. If you're looking for more ways to connect with the 178th Wing, you can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also write to us at beyondthehorizonpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep your eyes on the horizon.